to have Brother Michael Nakora address the convention. We've had many, many blessings from him in the past. And his subject is the blind spot. The blind spot. Brother Michael.
First of all, I want to extend the Christian loving greetings of your brethren in Los Angeles. And also the Wednesday night class, study class, that meets in the home of Wade and Lois Austin, voted to extend their love to the brethren in Chicago. It's just an absolute delight when they say, we have to send our love to Phoenix. And I say, just a minute, there's another convention. But Phoenix is within driving distance, and so almost everybody in Southern California, when they go to convention at New Year's time, go to Phoenix. Those that are in our area that used to live in this area also wanted to be sure that their love was sent. Val Conrad from Milwaukee wanted to make sure that all the brethren from Milwaukee understood that he still knows them, loves them, wants his love sent to them. And also, if there's anybody in Chicago that knows him, yes, you're remembered too. Sam and Jean Christick, who have been away from the Gary, Indiana area so long that I would have thought they wouldn't even know where Indiana was, have very fond memories and recollections of the brethren that they met with here in the Illinois-Indiana area. They wanted their love sent. And because I'm getting older and my mind is slowly going, there are probably many others that wanted to be remembered to you also. And if I didn't mention them, the fault is mine. It is not theirs. Now I want to stimulate David Stein and invite you to the International Convention, which is only 7 months away. I know that you've all been thinking that it is an eternity away. It is 7 months away. There are new newsletters out there on the table. The program is on the flip side of the newsletter. If you are thinking about going and haven't made a reservation, you can save a postage stamp by just telling me, and that's about all you have to do. And if you are not going or think you can't go, if you could just remember the convention in prayer, that would be very much appreciated, too. This is an every two-year occurrence. It seems to be like every 2 months, but it's really every 2 years, and those newsletters are out. Now I'll go back and simulate myself and say that there is a convention that occurs over the 4th of July in Los Angeles, and probably for the first time in memory, we have our programs ready so that we can put them out at Chicago and Phoenix. And we understand that there is another convention at 4th of July time that does attract some of you to it, but they don't have their programs out. So just wanted to let you know that they're there on the book table, and feel free to help yourself. I'm going to read to you, but I'm not going to tell you where, because I know you guys are going to turn to it and you're going to miss the whole point. And so I'm going to read to you, and then I'll tell you where I read from, because I'm going to read it from the NIV, which is my current favorite translation of the Greek into English. And this is what it says. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank that is in your own? How can you say to your brother, brother, let me take that speck out of your eye, when you yourself fail to see the plank that is in your own eye? You hypocrite! First take out the plank out of your eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck that is in your brother's eye. That's Luke, the 6th chapter, verses 41 and 42. Now, you know, I know, the Lord is not talking about literal sawdust, nor does he think that anybody is carrying around a literal plank in their eye. But as a figure of speech, this is vivid language. You think that you see some small defect in a brother or sister. You're eager to correct that situation. However, you don't realize that you possess a far greater defect, which in comparison is kind of like a grain of sawdust and a plank. How could that be? How could it possibly be true that you do not see a defect in yourself. The condition is called the blind spot. Now, there is such a thing as a literal blind spot. It's in the back of your eye. The back of each eye has a nerve bundle that comes into the back. And at that one spot where it enters the retina, it is not sensitive to light. You don't see. But you do see. I mean, you look around and you see, and there is no black spot floating around. Why is that? Answer, the brain fills in what it thinks ought to be there. And does a pretty good job, actually, about that. And so you go around until you get your eyes examined, and with the right kinds of instruments, they can detect if you have a medical condition back there. But the word has come to take on other connotations. The dictionary defines the blind spot as an area where one fails to exercise judgment or discrimination. But of course, one's brain supplies the missing information, and so you're not even aware of the failure. Take a moment and think about yourself. There are things you know about yourself. Now, others around you, seated around you at this convention, also know things about you. There are four possibilities. Possibility one, there are things you know about yourself and others know them too. That's the first possibility. And that's the public you. That's the you that you've chosen to share with everybody. You may, for example, dress well, speak well. You may have a good sense of humor. Your height, your weight, you could fudge it a little, but by and large, pretty well known. Unless you've lied about it, people generally know your age, your family relatives, your background in the truth, your job, although that's something I never seem to know. People ask me, what does he do? And I don't know. But it's the sort of thing that could be known. That's you. That's the you that you've chosen to share. Possibility number two. These are the things that you don't know and others don't know. And it's therefore not of very much interest. I don't want to alarm you, but you could be dying of a fatal disease right now. You don't know it. Other people don't know it. Only God knows it. And if He chooses not to reveal it to us, then that's the way it remains. So we're not interested in that. Category three. These are things you know about yourself, but others don't know. You've chosen not to reveal it. It's the private you. You don't share it. I mean, for example, you know how devoted you are to the Lord. I mean, others might guess, but they could be very, very wrong on that. But you know. You may be struggling with a particular trial, a particular sin. You don't talk about it. And it's a private struggle that's going on. Hypocrisy is something that you could be suffering from. You know it, but others don't know it. The Greek word hypocrisy describes what an actor does. He knows he's acting, but often others don't know it. Especially if the acting is very, very good. When we know something about ourselves, and we don't like it, and we keep it secret, we can still do something about it if we try. And most of the time, that's what we hear about from the platform. But we're not going to talk about that today. That isn't what's of interest to us today. It's category four that's of interest to us today. And that's the sins that we're not working on because we don't know about them. It's the things that other people know about you and you don't know them. It's the plank you're carrying around as you inspect the others for their grains of sawdust. That's the blind spot. It's what interferes with your vision as you point out, of course, the defects in others. But, of course, in this case, how can you do something about it? You don't even know that you have a problem. You can't see anything that is in your blind spot. And, of course, your brain is busy supplying the missing information and doing it in a very clever way. How can you do anything about it? The answer is you have to reduce the size of your blind spot. Never goes to zero, but you can reduce it. You want to see a good example of a blind spot? Here goes. You can turn if you want. It's the sixth chapter of Luke, still the NIV. It's the opening verses. It's the time where Jesus and the disciples are going through the wheat field, and they're hungry. You remember it. The opening verses of Luke 6, NIV. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples began to pluck some of the heads of grain and rub them in their hands and then eat the kernels. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Which I suppose is threshing grain, separating the kernels from the husks. The Pharisees were quick to point out this minor infraction of the law that prohibits any work on the Sabbath. They saw the speck of sawdust in their brother's eye and were quick to point that out. And what were they carrying around in their eye? In the 20th chapter of Luke, and in the 47th verse, we read, of course you could fill in what the Pharisees were doing, but this is what our Lord says about them. The NIV for Luke 20:47. The teachers of the law devour widows' houses, and for a show make lengthy prayers. The Pharisees had an enormous blind spot. They could not see the plank that was in their own eye, yet they could clearly see the defects in others. Jesus called them blind guides. That's Matthew 23:24. Though, of course, they would hardly apply that characterization to themselves. He didn't say blind spot, but blind guides comes mighty close. Because we can see it in them, it stands as a warning to us that we could similarly be suffering from a defect and we don't even know it. In the 19th Psalm, verses 12 and 13, David articulates words worth pondering. It's the 19th Psalm, verses 12, beginning at 12 and going to 13. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. You may not have thought about it, but I'd like to suggest that when David is here articulating about secret faults, they are the faults we don't see because they're hidden by our blind spot. David is not asking to be cleansed from sins that he doesn't know about and will never know about. That's not what he's praying for. He knows the necessary first step is to make it visible. Then something can be done about it. The Pharisees never really saw the prejudice they had against the poor and what favor that they had for those of their own class. they appeared to be absolutely blind, even though Jesus tried to get them to see what it was that they were doing. I'll give you a hypothetical story. Once upon a time, a wealthy man just happened to see a beautiful woman while she was bathing. Now, even though he was already married, he was so impressed by what he saw that he arranged to meet her. And he slept with her. And she became pregnant. Now, that complicated matters a bit, because everybody knew that her husband was away from the city on an extended assignment, as it turns out, for the wealthy man, and he would probably be away for a very long time. So, to solve what seemed like an insurmountable problem, he arranged to have the husband killed. And then he married the woman. Do you see anything wrong here, by chance? If you were to talk to the wealthy man, do you suppose he would see anything wrong here? You don't have to guess about it. It's not a hypothetical story. Yes, it is. It's David. It's David. Wealthy people make their own rules. When you're king, there are certain privileges that go along with it, and after a while, you don't think twice. David has a very large blind spot. All the sordid details are in 2 Samuel chapter 11. The woman, of course, is Bathsheba. Now, your challenge, if you choose to accept it, is to go discuss this matter with the wealthy man, the king, David. Just how do you intend to proceed? Do you really think for a moment that if you say 2 times 2 is 4, or the equivalent, you know, look what you did. You committed adultery, you murdered, do you think that, he knows all this. Do you think you really will get to first base with this? I mean, blind spots don't cave in easily. The brain has been very good at this over the years, and it knows how in this case, I don't know, I'm king, I can do what I want. Well, God, in the 12th chapter of 2 Samuel, God sends the prophet Nathan. Prophets had difficult jobs in those days, and his job is to eliminate the blind spot. But you can't eliminate it by a frontal attack. It won't work. So, the instructions are the indirect approach. And this is what Nathan does. He begins with a story. The first verse, 2 Samuel 12, we are sticking with the NIV. It doesn't start once upon a time, but I'm going to start it that way. Once upon a time, there were two men in a certain town. One was rich, one was poor. The rich man had a very large number of cattle and sheep, but the poor man had nothing except this one little ewe lamb. Now the traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. So instead, he took the little ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one that had come to him. And David burned with anger against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man that did this thing deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb 4 times over because he did such a thing. He had no pity." And then Nathan said to David, "You are the man." And just to make sure that he gets the point, he goes on to say, "You murdered Uriah. You took his wife to be your wife." And David is stunned. You can see the blind spot going poof, just like that. He doesn't know what to do except to confess his sin. David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Now, it was sometime after this incident that he wrote the words of Psalm 51. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions. My sin is ever before me. For sure, we can commend David for the quickness to confess the sin and to seek forgiveness. That is commendable. But brethren, acts have consequences. Always have, always will. Whether we do wrong blindly, or whether we do wrong deliberately, there is a price to be paid. And David paid a great price. He was not an exception. Now, he didn't lose his life. Could have. The law said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life. Could have lost his life. Didn't happen. Do you want to know the consequences from this act? I'll give you four. Number one, this is verse 10. And I don't have the foggiest notion what chapter we're in, but it is definitely verse 10. Nathan says to him, you will never live in peace. And it was true. If you read, from this moment forward until David dies, he had nothing but trouble from that moment on. Bathsheba's grandfather was Ahithophel. He was one of David's trusted counselors before the event. But after it, he worked against him, and he even told Absalom, I'll kill David for you. Number two, verse 11. Evil will come out of your own house. And it happened. The very next chapter, one of David's sons rapes one of his daughters. Then the daughter's brother murders the rapist, who is, of course, his half-brother. As with David's own sin, sexual immorality is again followed by murder. But this time in his own house. Consequence number three in verse 11. Your wives will be defiled openly. In chapter 16, 2 Samuel, verse 22, his concubines were defiled by Absalom, his son. As a show of power, it was done in front of all Israel. Verse 14, Bathsheba's child will die. And of course it did. We have all seen, maybe if you go back into the recesses of your mind, you might have seen yourself sowing wild oats. How curious that those who do it act so surprised when they get a crop of wild oats. Lie? And you're going to be lied to. Show no respect for somebody else. The favor will be returned. God doesn't insulate us from the consequences of our acts. If he insulated us from our acts, we'd learn nothing from them. But just go on doing whatever it is that we pleased. All the while, of course, with our brain filling in the details, thinking we're doing just fine. So what's hidden away in your blind spot? What are you not willing to admit to yourself? Don't worry. David may have had an enormous blind spot. Do you think the people in the court didn't know what was going on? I mean, do you think that Uriah died at the front lines of battle and nobody knew it? Everybody knew what was going on. But it's like, but David. So don't worry. What we're talking about are the things that everybody else knows about you. But you don't know. Without work on your part, you'll never know. David didn't see his sin. Joab saw it because he carried out the orders. But none of these people told David about his sin. Joab didn't talk. None of the other people in the court talked to him about it. Why didn't they do it? Why aren't people coming to you and telling you about what they see that you can't see? Well, why should they? You're going to get mad. And besides, you're not going to believe them. So, and they know that. So, nobody's going to do that. Now, if you really want to know, not clear you do, but if you really want to know, you've got to work at it. This is hard work. Most of us have very little trouble giving others good advice. We see exactly what's wrong with them and what they should do about it. We see a speck of sawdust in their eye. We want to help them get rid of it. Good. Since we're also expert at giving good advice, question, how much good advice do we give ourselves? Right. Very little. And why is that? Well, don't see much wrong, really. Not too much to give advice about. Of course, with the others, we see so clearly, we have a lot of advice to give. Oh, that we had as much zeal to correct ourselves as we have the fondness to reprove and correct others. So how can we correct what we don't know about? Well, we can't. So the first job is to find out what is it that constitutes the plank in our own eyes. There's an exercise that's done with kids. In fact, at your next grown-up Bible student party, when you don't know what else to do, you can try this. It's an exercise to teach self-esteem, so adults could probably handle it. Each kid is given a blank piece of paper and is asked to pin it on his back. Okay, got that? And now every kid has a felt pen, same color, and they go around the room and everybody writes on each other's back one good thing about that person. One thing that they really like, you know, until, you know, everybody has written on everybody's back. And afterward, when all the writing is done, you sit down and everybody takes off the piece of paper, they hold it in front of themselves, and they read what others have written upon it. Now, suppose we did that here. Everybody walked around with a piece of paper pinned to their back, and everybody has felt the pens, and you say, just a moment, you know, I want to write something, but I don't know, I'll go five lines down so you can't psych it out afterwards as to, you know, who did it, and I'll print so that my handwriting won't give me away, you know, and this is all done. And then now it's over, and we take off the piece of paper, and we read it. How do you think you're going to feel when you read what others have said, what others have wrote about you? Would you say, oh, no, you know, that's not me. It's the wrong back. I mean, it's, you know, surely they're wrong. You know you won't. You'll glow. You'll love it. You'll love it. Frame it, probably, when you get home. That's the easy one. I do not suggest step two for the party of the grown-ups. It's usually too hard on them. Sometimes it's done with kids, though. But it's almost, we wouldn't dare do it. Actually, step one has been done at a Bible student convention. But step two is never done. Can you guess what step two is? Well, we have a new piece of paper. Okay. It's all pinned in place. Felt tip pens at the ready. And now the challenge is write one thing on the piece of paper that you think you see in the person, but you don't think they see about them. What are some of the things that you might write about people? Incidentally, I'm going to give you a list of things that could be there. Some of these have been written on my piece of paper by my lovely wife. But I am not going to tell you which ones they are. And so here we go with some of the things that might have been written on a hypothetical person's back. You always interrupt me before I can finish my thought. You talk as if you are the judge and the final judge about what is and what is not truth. You are the leader of a clique in this ecclesia, and I feel excluded. You belittle women by the way you talk about them. You insist that things be done your way. You show jealousy over the good fortune of someone else. Although you make mistakes, you say it's never your fault. Since nobody ever gives me an hour, I'll take a minute and give you one little interesting thing that happened. We had an instance where we had a relatively young boy and a relatively young girl come to the home every morning for breakfast, and I took him to school. It happened for a while, and there were reasons for why we were doing that. And one day during quality time, Nanette said, "You treat the boy differently than you treat the girl." "Oh, come on. I don't." "Yes, you do." I said, "I don't believe you." She said, "I'll show you." And so, of course, we had breakfast as we usually did. And suddenly I heard Nanette say, "There you go." "Oh, well, can you, that's like doesn't count." "It's all right." And lo and behold, it became very clear, finally, she was right. She was right. I mean, I don't have the foggiest notion. Yes, I do. I know why. But it was so conveniently hidden away that it was like something I never had to face. And they're not coming anymore, so I don't really know how I'm doing. But it was quite an interesting personal experience to sort of live through. Anyway, these were the hypothetical person. Game's over. It's time for you to take off your piece of paper, put it in front of you, and read it. Can you picture it? Can you even stand it? Are you going to argue and say, "That's not me. Got the wrong back on that one. I know who they meant to write that one on, but it wasn't me." Okay, so I have to cross that one out. That I have to cross the next one out, too. I don't think this was me at all. I mean, they have got the wrong person. Our minds are so willing to cover up any unpleasant truths about ourselves that we don't want to know about. The person who is physically blind is deprived of many privileges. Though he can still do a lot of wonderful things, he's still restricted. Blind spots in the mind restrict us because they generally produce bad character traits. Like David, we need to pray that these hidden sins be revealed and that we receive the needed help to cleanse ourselves from them. Now, because we don't go around with pieces of paper pinned to our back, we have no mechanism to know just what it is that others see that we don't see. So we must, from time to time, indulge in self-appraisal. In large businesses today, everybody gets an annual performance appraisal. One learns what good things were done and what things could be improved. Many managers hate to do appraisals because, although they may have some complaints, it's not so easy to deliver those complaints face to face. So let's face ourselves with honesty. Let's give ourselves an honest performance appraisal. Now, there's no point in trying to list all your shortcomings. The best results from a performance appraisal come from one that focuses on just one area for improvement in the coming year. You take an employee and dump all the things that you have, and nothing changes. Talk about one thing. I mean, super employee, I'm really glad that you're on the staff. I don't know what we'd do if we didn't have it. If there's one area, however, that if you can sort of work on, I mean, you'd even be better. You're likely to have something happen. And then a year from now, you've done a terrific job in this one. There is another area that, you keep this up for 5 or 6 years and lots of good would happen. So don't go off and make lots of resolutions for the next year. Just one area that you kind of like, no, but the blind spot is hiding it a little, that you might work on. Well, what'll that be? I don't know what it is for you, but let me give you a few hypothetical instances of things I've seen among brethren. It's like, maybe it's me and I don't see it, but I know who I might write this on the back of. Anger. Do you really expect that other people around you are going to control their tempers while you lose yours? From time to time, we hear about brethren, yes, even elders, who are so sure they are right, they lose control of themselves in a fit of anger. Proverbs 27:4, wrath is cruel, anger outrageous. If this is you, please, don't tell us how in your case the anger is righteous indignation. If you realize that you have in the past given in to anger and wrath, then start to do something about it. And start now. Well, the problem might not be anger. It might be partiality. Now, I would love to use the word prejudice because it's a stronger word. There's a small problem, and that's that it's not found in the Bible. But the thought certainly is. The idea that we, like the Pharisees, would treat some as first-class citizens and others as second-class citizens. Yeah, and maybe some as 10th-class citizens. That behavior is definitely condemned in the Scriptures. 1 Timothy 5:21. Paul writes to Timothy, he says, I charge thee before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that thou observe these things without preferring one before another, doing nothing by partiality. Prejudice, of course, is the stronger word. James 3:17. The wisdom that is from above is without partiality, it is without hypocrisy. Now, if this is you, please don't tell us about how even the Lord had his favorites within the ranks of the disciples. And so it's okay for you to have favorites too. If you realize that, yes, you have been prejudicial, partial in your dealings with brethren, then start to do something about it and start now. Maybe Maybe it isn't partiality. Maybe it isn't anger. What about envy? In Job chapter 5, verse 2, the NIV translates the Hebrew this way. Resentment kills a fool, and envy slays the simple. The Hebrew word envy is Strong's 7068. The word is also translated jealousy. Envy. It's a word defined as resentful awareness of an advantage that is enjoyed by another, with a desire to possess the same advantage. Now, generally, if it works on the mind, the next step after envy takes root is you satisfy the desire. You want what somebody else has, and you are going to get it. If you are king, you act on your desire and you take what you want. David took Bathsheba. Ahab murdered Naboth, and he took his vineyard. But you're not king, so you have to do something else. Although you might convince yourself that you have no envy, others usually know better by the things that you say. If this is you, please, don't tell us how unworthy others are for whatever advantages that they happen to be enjoying, and how worthy you are, what you could do if you had those advantages. If you have feelings of envy, start to do something about it, and start now. I've heard it said that a person's character is pretty much established by the age of 30. What you are at that age is generally what you are at the age of 60 and 70 and 80. But brethren, that's the rule for the world. We have to go against the tide. We must try to control and correct our own conduct. Romans 12:1 is pretty popular. Romans 12:2 from Phillips. Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold, but let God remake you so that your whole attitude of mind is changed. Now, we all know about the narrow way and about how few there are that find it. Well, the reason that so few find it is that there are so few interested in walking contrary to the world. If we think that we have no character defects or that we have nothing to correct in ourselves, then we are deceiving ourselves. We have a very large blind spot. Ephesians, the 4th chapter. Verses are 22 to 24. The reading is from the NIV. Ephesians 4. You were taught, with regard to your former way of life, to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Verse 31, get rid of all bitterness, all rage, all anger. Be kind, be compassionate one to another, forgiving each other, just as Christ forgave you, just as in Christ God forgave you. You know, it really would be better if we could all listen better. If we could all listen better, we might learn a lot. They never teach us how to do that. They teach reading, writing, arithmetic, but they don't teach how to listen. So consequently, most of us never really learned to listen. But if we could improve our listening skill, we might just hear someone suggest how we might be more effective, how we could do a better job, how we could be a better Christian, how we could lead a study more effectively, or be a more effective as an elder, or a deacon, or a member of a class. You hear it, and you don't want to hear it. But we're going to change that, because we're going to pretend that at that moment in time, somebody with a felt tip pen just wrote something on our blank piece of paper we were carrying around on our back. Don't argue. Don't say on a scale to 1 to 10, I'm, well, 6 anyway. And, you know, it's better than could have been. You don't have to defend yourself. You don't have to do anything except think about it. Just think about it. Don't defend. Don't say, it's not me. I know who it is, but it's certainly not me. Maybe it is true. Maybe it is true. And maybe our blind spot is keeping us from seeing it. James 1:19. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. Wow, is that hard? Slow to wrath. Read in the newspaper about an interview that went on with a Mormon missionary. Now, you know about the Mormon missionaries, how when they finish high school, learn that they go to 1 year of college, and then 2 years out in the missionary field, often in very undesirable environments. And it's hard to believe, but yes, Los Angeles has a couple of those. And into those areas, a couple of Mormon missionaries went, and the reporter for the LA Times reported on the experiences that they were having. And this was the thing that caught my eye. When he saw where they lived, there was a big poster on the wall, and although he didn't say, I get the impression God is speaking. And this is what he says. I never said it would be easy. I only said it would be worth it. Not a bad description of the narrow way. Let us keep making progress. Let us help our brethren who are walking in the same narrow way so that we all may reach the prize for which we seek. 200 years ago, the Scottish poet Robert Burns wrote well-known words, oh, that some power the gift would give us to see ourselves as others see us. 'Twould from many a blunder free us. This is the day people make resolutions. I never made resolutions. Figured that if something was a good idea, I ought to do it right away, not wait for the end of the year. Then I was reading Time magazine. Time magazine, Peacemakers on the cover. Probably see it. Rabin, Arafat, the clerk, Mandela. I read this. Everybody, after all, builds a future on a resolve not to repeat old blunders. That's a pretty good resolution. I decided, I think I'm going to make that one. Have you made old blunders? Oh, I know. Before I got married, I could cover them up better, but... Yeah, I've made them. I would like not to make them again. I can't do anything about the fact that I made them, but I'd like not to make them again. So that's kind of like my New Year's resolution. I resolve not to repeat old blunders. I'll probably make some new ones, but then I'll try not to repeat those too. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. The Lord tells us that the standard that we apply to others will be the standard that is applied to us. In Luke, the 6th chapter, verses 37 and 38, from the NIV, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure that you use, it will be measured unto you. May the Lord help us all to overcome our secret faults.
Thank you, Brother Michael, for those very practical and helpful suggestions. It does make me hesitate, though, to turn my back on you. But feel free to write whatever you want. Thank you very much, though. I appreciate those thoughts very much. And Brother Michael will dismiss us, and we will reconvene at 5 o'clock.
And now again, our dear Heavenly Father, we as thy children come to thee in prayer to thank thee for all that thou hast done for us, for calling us out of darkness into thy marvelous light of truth and understanding. We thank thee, too, for the gift of thy dear Son who died for us, and through whose sacrifice we have the opportunity of walking this narrow way in newness of life before thee. Indeed, like David of old, we would pray that thou wilt cleanse us from our secret faults, which means, of course, that we will be ever on the alert to listen and to be aware that we might correct those things that would be displeasing to thee. Help us to be faithful in the things that thou hast committed to each one of us, and help us to be a blessing to those we come in contact here at the convention, that it might be edifying for all those that are here. We would remember those that have special needs too, the sick, the isolated, the afflicted. May they feel thy presence near in their times of need. And now continue to be with us, especially in the further sessions of this convention, for we ask and pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.